Hello and welcome to this week's Inside Education. Our website is insideed.com. My name is Sean Delaney. On this week's programme, I'm bringing you an interview with an Irish woman who graduated from Carisford College here in Ireland, but who has had a successful career as an education academic in the United States. After spending some time teaching in Ireland, Angela O'Donnell was awarded a doctorate and two master's degrees by Texas Christian University. Angela O'Donnell is a professor and educational psychology at Rutgers University, who has made substantial contributions to the understanding of collaborative learning. She is interested in how students can help each other learn. She has also expertise in knowledge maps. She co-authored the college textbook Educational Psychology: Reflection for Action. I met up with Angela O'Donnell on the fringes of an educational conference recently. Although it was occasionally a little bit noisy in the background, she shared many of her ideas with me, and I began by asking Angela to tell me the difference between collaborative and cooperative learning.
Cooperative learning is often considered a very structured form of collaborative learning, whereas collaborative learning in and of itself is not structured. So a fairly classic example of cooperative learning would be Slavin's student teams, achievement divisions, whereas collaborative learning is more open-ended, unstructured kind of strategy. I don't think you can have cooperative learning without collaboration going on, but you can have collaboration without cooperation, because it really depends on a belief in the interdependence of the goals of the people involved.
You talked there about Slavin's work. Can you say a little bit more about that?
I've always liked his work. He started doing work on cooperative learning in 1975. And he worked with inner city schools of kids who were basically failing within the schools, and was able to actually improve achievement of these kids fairly dramatically. And these would be kids that the school systems had pretty much given up on. And he basically, with cooperative learning, he renormed the goals of the kids to actually being oriented towards achievement, where they actually wanted to succeed, whereas prior to that, success in school was considered not cool for some of these kids, particularly in the inner cities.
And how did he do that? Was it the kind of tasks that he set for them in groups?
He uses group rewards. So the teacher does his or her normal teaching, whatever style they choose to use. And then the kids work in heterogeneous groups of 4 to 6 kids to practice the content and go over the content with one another, and they work from fairly structured worksheets to actually do that. And their goal is to make sure that every child in the group actually understands the content and can actually answer these questions. Then every kid does an individual quiz, and depending on how they've improved over their baseline score, they get X number of points to bring back to the group. And so one of the things I really like about it is the high achiever and the low achiever have equal opportunity to contribute equally to the group. Whereas if you don't use improvement points, the high achiever gets frustrated with the low achiever, and the low achiever feels demoralized, and, you know, they don't contribute equally to the group, so there can be tension within the interpersonal dynamics of the group. So by using improvement points to where each child can contribute, he's been able to get the kids to actually buy into the whole cooperative learning thing. Depending then on the group points, he awards certificates or other rewards to the best achieving teams. So the teams are kind of competing with one another, but cooperating within the group. And nothing unites like a common enemy, so when they're competing with the other groups, they're actually collaborating and cooperating with one another to do the best they can. And it's been pretty successful. One of the downsides is that it really is only good for fairly basic skills, because the kids can't make judgments about the quality of responses that other kids give. And so a lot of the worksheets that he gives tend to be low-level kind of cognitive objectives.
So that's interesting that children are not necessarily, or learners and students are not necessarily good at giving each other feedback. Is that what you're saying?
Right. It varies, but a lot of kids have trouble giving appropriate help. A lot of adults have trouble giving appropriate help at the right level that the learner needs it. So there are qualities, you know, sometimes I think the student who's doing the explaining is actually benefiting more than the student for whom the explanation has been given, because they're getting a chance to restructure how they think about content.
So when you're talking about collaborative and cooperative learning, then, are you thinking about a particular age group, or are you thinking of all age groups?
I'm thinking of all age groups. It's been used in, you know, through college groups and medical schools. Engineering schools use a lot of cooperative learning, particularly at the undergraduate level. The content is difficult, and it's very isolating to be trying to do it on your own, and the students do benefit from sharing answers with one another and trying to problem solve why they can't get the answers.
And how young can learners start to collaborate and cooperate?
I've had some students do some papers on kids as young as 3 and 4. And one of the difficulties, I think that's a little too early because they don't have the ability to take the perspective of another person that young, but certainly as young as second grade or first grade would be well able to actually do this. It just needs to be organized very carefully for them. And so there's lots of prompts and help available to them so they don't have to remember all the steps themselves.
So if we take those youngest children, say, in second or third grade, how can a teacher prepare them for working in those kind of groups?
Starting with pairs of students is usually helpful. Some of the Kagan structures, I don't know if you're familiar with those. He has some very simple structures for getting kids to interact with one another. One is called Think, Pair, Share. So the teacher would ask a question, ask the kids to think about an answer, then pair them up and have them share their answers with each other, and then talk back to the whole class about what they've actually come up with. So doing some of these very simple kind of structures to get them used to exchanging ideas is actually very helpful. Depending, you know, you may also need to teach some social skills in terms of how to be polite to one another, how not to disrespect one another, letting somebody finish a sentence before interrupting, which can be hard for him, particularly the eager kids who are, you know, jumping up and down ready to tell you the answers.
As they mature then and, say, go through the secondary school grades, what kind of shape does cooperative and collaborative learning take then?
It depends on the subject area, I think. You know, in a lot of science labs, for instance, people often use pairs of students or groups of four. They may use them as same gender because at the secondary level, girls may defer to boys with respect to some sort of laboratory experiments where the boy is actually doing the work and the girl is reading the directions. So some of the science teachers I've worked with prefer to have same gender groups at the secondary level so that both genders are actually participating equally in all of the tasks necessary for the activity itself. With mathematics, there's much more open-ended structures. There's things like literature circles, so some of it is fairly domain-specific in terms of fitting it, you know, the structure to what you actually want to accomplish.
And do some students learn better alone than in groups?
Certainly some students believe they do. Rachel Lotan talks about group-worthy tasks. And these are tasks that are complex enough to where a single student can't do it on his or her own, but needs actual help. So the kind of belief behind her approach to collaborative learning is that some of us have many of the skills needed for the task, but none of us have all of the skills needed for the tasks. So getting a task that's challenging enough, if a kid can do it all on his own quite rapidly, it's not going to be interested in just slowing down to take time with other people to actually do the task.
You've kind of touched on this already, but if you think of the group, and you think that there should be mixed ability groups working, but one of the reasons that some students might like working in a group is maybe they might feel that they could work better on their own, or they might feel that maybe somebody in a group is a passenger. How do you avoid that kind of situation?
Some of it is by doing contracts with the kids. In the college classes I've used, I have students develop a contract of expectations with one another in terms of what they're willing to contribute and what are going to be outcomes if they don't contribute. So they decide before problems arise how they're going to actually respond to the problems, and then I have them refer back to their contract every so often just to say, are you still on board with this? Are you violating the contract? What are you going to do about it? And that really is kind of a prevention is better than cure approach, really to alert them to the possibility of problems and to make it a little more public if they actually engage in these problems, because some of the kids who are social loafers who like to let everybody else do the work are also a little cowardly about it. They don't really want other people to notice. So if everyone is put on notice at the beginning, you could have one of these people in your group. It's a little harder to be that person. And I think that works well with the more secondary grades.
And if you have a teacher who's thinking about doing some group work and is either reluctant to do it or doesn't know how to go about doing it, what would you say to them in terms of giving them advice on how to do it?
I would start them off with pairs of students. It's non-threatening. It really doesn't violate problems of classroom management. Doing something like the think, pair, shared, or something that I've used, scripted cooperation, where they actually, you know, would summarize to one another. The second person would engage in metacognition about whether the person summarizing has made errors, and then both participants would actually try to elaborate on the content and connect it to something they already know. And so this is a very structured way of dealing with it, and it's kind of reassuring for a nervous teacher, because it's, you know, if you're new to using groups, the idea of letting your whole class get into groups of four and five, and, you know, depending on the size of the class, managing five or six separate groups and there's only one of you is a little daunting. But I think once you get people prepared on this with small steps and build up to more complex kind of interactions, I think it works pretty well. And I think it's a little more reassuring for new teachers, or, you know, new teachers who are new to cooperative learning. And they, you know, eventually have to buy into the belief that students are going to learn just as well in this way as by the classroom teacher. And one of the, when I was in graduate school, one of my professors was doing a study of cooperative learning in public schools. And one of the teachers who was most difficult to work with was the teacher of the year in the state. Because she really couldn't accept the idea that, you know, she was the best teacher in the state, so how could these kids possibly actually teach each other as well as she was teaching them? And it made the research very difficult. She could have been right, but it's not, you know, sometimes if you have people whose pride is invested in their teaching skill rather than in the students' learning skills, it's a real problem, of, you know, because they have different goals.
How has the idea of cooperative and collaborative learning changed in a technology-rich era?
It's made it possible to do collaboration, you know, distance-wise, and be more reflective, to where students can actually think before they actually say something. And some students actually like it much better in a sort of an online format, because they're not compelled to respond immediately. They can actually give some thought to what they want to say. I think it's enhanced the opportunities for people to participate, not just locally, but, you know, across countries and across different districts. It allows kids access to different kinds of expertise that can scaffold their learning. So pairing up students with mentors in other places is possible. So I think it's just broadened the scope of what's possible.
Do you think parents get worried at the idea of their children engaged in group work, that they would be maybe concerned that the children are maybe talking about the football game that was on last night or something like that?
I think they would be concerned about that. I think teachers have the same concerns. The other concern I think parents have, particularly of more high-achieving children, is that their children are being used as teaching assistants, and maybe they're not being taught as well as they should be. And what nobody really explains to parents is that the child who's actually doing the explaining actually has more cognitive opportunities to actually teach. The old adage, to teach is to learn twice. If you give a student an opportunity to teach, they're going to deepen their understanding of the content and be able to reframe it and be more flexible with the knowledge. But that idea is not communicated to parents very effectively. So I think those are legitimate concerns that parents would have and should raise, and teachers should be able to give them an explanation for why their child would benefit from this format. I think parents of, you know, less achieving children would see some immediate benefit of having some extra tutorial services available, but the parent of the high achiever is probably very nervous that maybe their child is not getting the best that the education system has to offer, and they're being used instead to help other people's kids, when in fact probably the reverse is true, that the child who actually gets to be a leader actually gets more experience with the content and a deeper understanding of it.
That's interesting. All right.
Dublin Radio at its best, 103.2. This is Dublin City FM.
Another area you've conducted research into is that of knowledge maps.
Yes.
What is a knowledge map?
If you've heard of concept maps, they're basically graphical organization of knowledge. And knowledge maps is a particular technique developed by Donald Dansereau, who is my dissertation advisor. And they're different from concept maps because in a concept map you have ideas in circles connected to other ideas by just unnamed links. And in a knowledge map, these links are named so that you actually specify the relationship between two ideas. So, you know, a wing is a part of a bird. So you would have bird and wing connected by a line that had a little P over it. And so what the student is learning while they're actually either developing these or learning from prepared ones is the set of relationships between ideas and how they actually go together. And the, you know, the students, we've used them in a variety of ways. We've used them as substitutes for text, which are quite useful for kids who have low verbal ability and have trouble reading, because it really takes a lot of the verbiage out of the actual textual material and focuses them on understanding ideas and the relationship with ideas without getting obstructed by a lack of language capacity. Another way we've used them is to have people fill in a partially completed map, and then we've had kids do them on their own from scratch, and that's the hardest thing for them to do, because they have to deal with just the idea, the generation of ideas, the connecting of ideas, and the labeling of those connections.
So they can be used in a lot of different ways then, either as a way of receiving information or a way of processing information.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. And again, what age group are they used with?
This is probably more like senior elementary, primary grades, children, secondary school students can really easily handle them, and I've used them at the college level as well. Don Dansereau has used knowledge maps in a counseling situation with incarcerated, you know, juvenile prisoners who've been incarcerated by drug offenses. And one of the characteristics of this population is they're often, you know, low achieving. They've not done well in school. They don't know how to read very well. And he's used these knowledge maps as problem representations, where if they are, you know, addicted to alcohol, that they would draw out the situations in which they feel vulnerable to taking alcohol, and try to label the relationships between the things that are going on in a situation. And he's actually been very successful with these students. So they can be used in a variety of disciplines and for a variety of purposes.
It sounds like they'd be very good for revising work that you'd already encountered, maybe some other way.
I think so. I think they can they're very useful as startups to writing, to where you lay out your ideas and the relationships between them, and then you can organize them, the order in which they go in. Whereas if you start writing from scratch, you know, one idea leads to the other, and you don't necessarily look back to make sure that there's a logical evolution of the ideas themselves.
It's almost like a kind of a precursor for hyperlinked text.
Yes.
In terms of, you know, the relationship between ideas.
Yeah, we've used some hyperlinked text with this basic idea. Using these, we have relationship-guided searching, so if you were doing statistics, for example, and you wanted to look at the concept average, and you might look at types of average, you know, a mean, a median, a mode, and then you might look at variance and types of variance. So we would use the links for students to actually pick the next thing that they wanted, so that they were actually picking the next content based on its connection to the previous content rather than just randomly clicking.
And does the learning for the students come from using it or talking about it and sharing it with others?
It's probably best done by using it and sharing it with others and explaining their ideas. I don't know if you're familiar with knowledge forums that Marlene Scardamalia did in Canada. And this was basically a whole class-wide kind of knowledge map where students would contribute ideas to a database that was shared with the entire class, and other students could comment on it or annotate those ideas. So a student might contribute, "My theory is..." And then another student might say, "Evidence for your theory could be, you know, this." And so they would build up this database of knowledge that was jointly shared by the entire class. And she's found that to be very successful in improving kids' scores on standardized testing, in addition to their own, local designed assessments. So there's lots of interesting things that can be done with these, both in a technologically supported format and in a more paper format. And depending on the resources of the school, it's nice to have the flexibility to have something that works, that doesn't have to depend on very expensive technology, because schools aren't that particularly funded for, you know, keeping up with advances in technology. By the time schools have a suite of technological tools available to them, the industry has moved on and the kids don't want to use the stuff in school because they've got better stuff at home, and what they have available to them in school may not be sufficient. That will change, I think, as kids move towards having more of their textbooks on iPads and other kind of tablets, and those become substitutes for the 40-pound backpacks that kids are carrying around.
As apart from Googling knowledge maps, is there anywhere in particular teachers could find out more about them if they did want to try them with their classes?
That's a good question. There hasn't really been what probably needs to be done is to develop a text specifically for teachers, showing them actually how to use them, that would be accessible and practical, as opposed to, you know, research-based and obscure. Right now, I think if they Googled it, they would find things that are pretty inaccessible to, you know, a regular teacher who doesn't have time to actually try to figure out the research designs, but needs some practical ideas of how these might be used. And I think that would actually be a real contribution.
You are the lead author of a widely used textbook called Educational Psychology. How did that book come about?
It has a funny origin. My colleague John Marshall, who's the second author, was approached by this company to see if he would do it, because he had done two books on motivation for them. And he said he didn't have time, so he suggested me. And I said I didn't have time. And so we got a third person involved, and the three of us decided, well, you know, none of us have time to do an entire book on our own, but the three of us could split it, and we have three different areas of expertise, which actually worked very well together. Marshall's an expert in motivation, Jeff is in assessment, and I do the cognitive chapters. So we ended up kind of yielding to the pressure from the publisher by offering them three people rather than one. And it turned out to be a very good collaborative experience.
That's widely used in universities now around the United States.
Not as widely as we would like, but it is pretty well used, and there's a Canadian edition of it as well. And somebody sent me a copy from China, where it was translated into Chinese, and I couldn't tell whether there were typos in it or not. So it was really kind of funny to see it in a completely different language that's inaccessible to me.
How influential has psychology been on education practice relative to other foundation disciplines like sociology, philosophy, history?
I'm speaking from a little bit of a biased perspective because I'm a psychologist. So I don't know that my colleagues in anthropology or sociology would agree with me. They're probably all very important, but I think in terms of what goes on in classrooms, the interaction between the teacher and the child is very much an interpersonal interaction and depends very much on psychological understanding of the child's ability to learn and be motivated. I think some of the other foundational disciplines really address the context in which that personal relationship is occurring. So if you're in a low socioeconomic classroom, then sociology and anthropology would have a lot to tell you about issues of equity and status that are influencing the context in which that psychological relationship occurs.
What ideas in psychology have been particularly influential, in your view, on education?
I think one of the things that maybe is not as influential as it needs to be is this sort of understanding of memory that has come out of cognitive psychology. I mean, one of the things that is most important to us as teachers is having students actually learn things in a way that they will remember them and be able to use them. But a lot of practicing teachers have very poor theories about memory and don't have good ideas about how to support it or how it limits what's possible in the classroom. So I think that's probably one of the key ideas.
And in a future programme, I'll bring you some of Angela's ideas about how teachers can develop children's memory. And that was Professor Angela O'Donnell, who's originally from Ireland, but now a respected professor at Rutgers University in the United States. Well, that's all we have time for on this week's programme. If you'd like to contact me, you can write to me by email to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to my guest this week, Angela O'Donnell. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening. Thank you.